decided to solve the student's problem, then does it become the teacher's problem?
But the teacher, here's the point, that the teacher can't solve the student's problem. He can help, he might be able to help the student solve his own problem. But he can't solve the problem for him. That's the idea.
But it doesn't become this teacher's problem by helping the student to solve the problem.
That is often a problem that most teachers have, or many teachers have. They treat the student's problem as if it was their own problem, and it's not in their control whether they can solve it or not. It's like when you're, if I decide that you have a problem, that you don't live in India, would you stay in Brazil, or where do you stay?
Venezuela.
In where?
Venezuela.
Venezuela. So often, a teacher will decide the student has a problem with something, like your problem that you live in Venezuela. So I'm going to solve that problem for you and help you move to India. But the only trouble is that you don't want to move to India, that you don't see it as a problem that you're living in Venezuela. You see it's quite a good thing. So it becomes such a fight. So if the teacher sees that a student has a problem, and the student acknowledges that he has a problem and requests the teacher to help him, then it's a nice relationship. But if the teacher thinks that it's his responsibility to solve the student's problem even before the student even accepts that he has the problem, that it is a problem, and that he wants the teacher's help, it doesn't work at all. Good question. That's the essence of the issue that we're trying to raise here. That teachers often try to force students to solve problems that the students don't want to solve. And therefore, all the problems of those students become the teacher's problems in that way. And he becomes overburdened with problems that he doesn't have the power to solve. I don't have the power to make you come and live in India. And if I make it my business to make sure that you move to India, I'm going to be very frustrated. And I have, not only do I want to force you to do that, and I know what's wrong with you, and I'm going to help you with that, I'm going to help him with this, and help him with this, and help him with this. And I already have a lot of problems for to begin with. See, there's a saying even in counseling that you don't counsel people unless they hire you, so to speak. We don't mean by hiring, pay you. We mean to say that unless someone wants your advice, you don't give it. Because we all have the experience. People are offering us advice all the time that we don't care to hear. So if a person is not only giving advice, but expecting people to follow it, he's going to be very frustrated. Other questions?
Yeah, this directly relates to what we're just saying, but is there like a necessity for the teacher to not become too familiar with the students, for there to be some, I know sometimes like a little children, if you get to know them just playing around, then you want to be a superior authority, it's hard to. So should the teacher sort of have some kind of a emotional distance from the students?
I think that's a separate issue, but addressing that question is, yeah, the Western concept of intimacy is with no, is like Vrindavan bhakti, Vraja bhakti, that is equality. Even though the one is a superior, it is just like the devotees of Vrindavan, they feel themselves completely equal with Krishna. But in relationships, or in the beginning in devotional service, what's needed first is some awe and reverence. So this, or else we'll have equal relationship with God. But that's just thinking in that way. But it's the same as not having any relationship with Him at all, practically. So between teachers and students, there has to be some differences in reverence, of course. So in the modern concept of education, I think that's going to get in the way of intimacy. But it's a mistake. Thinking like that is a mistake. The teacher will lose his ability to teach, not only with young students, but all students. Or otherwise, if you're all equal, then why is one the teacher and one's the student? Any other questions?
An example of a problem that affects the teacher, but in a different circumstance, like not necessarily teaching the student, let's say like the president.
Right.
In that situation is a little different. I think a lot of times you wouldn't really want to use the, the force or the authority. What other? Because like just counseling and authority, that already can do much.
Well, there's many alternatives, but it's the same thing in the classroom. You don't always want to use authority. A good manager is able to manage, and it goes very smoothly with very little problems. And he's not always doing it in an authoritative way. He's not always pulling out that I'm the teacher or I'm the manager, and you have to do what I say. There is the element of inspiration. And as I tried to explain in the beginning of the class, a good teacher makes it look effortless. Because he knows how to get, somehow or another, he manipulates the atmosphere to get the students to want to learn what he is teaching. And then when someone wants to learn what you are teaching, then it's easy to teach them, or half the battle is won. Or if someone wants to follow the temple president, and it's not very difficult to manage. So it's somehow, very subtly, there's a manipulation of the atmosphere. Not manipulation in an insincere sense, but there's a manipulation of the atmosphere so a good manager wants the people under him in the temple to follow. They want to follow. They have some trust in him. They know that it will please their spiritual master. They trust his ability. They respect him. Different qualities that he has in way of dealing, affectionate with. They know that he cares for them. And his management is not selfish. But he's doing what he's doing for their welfare. So there's ways that non-verbal, it's not that the temple president is always evoking that verbally, but in a subtle way, his qualities naturally evoke the surrender and the cooperation, or the surrender even of the devotees. So teacher doesn't want to do that either. That's low level teaching. We're okay, I'm the teacher, everyone sit properly, line up, blah, blah, blah. Because then what happens is they're very good, if you use authority all the time, they're very good as soon as when you're sitting there, because of your power. And anyone who doesn't isn't doing their homework in 4 seconds, they immediately stand in the corner for 5 minutes, or they go to see the headmaster. So that will work, but as soon as the teacher leaves the room, they all... As soon as he removes the force, there's riot. But that's not very expert teaching. So how to be that kind of a person who others want to cooperate with? if that, I don't think that was your question, but that's a very deep question. We talked about it in the beginning of the class a little bit, you know, what makes a good teacher. Now, a question came up to me yesterday as I was circulating around with different students, and it came up last time we discussed this last year as well, is what happens when a student has a problem. For instance, he's not chanting japa. So whose problem is it? It's his problem. It doesn't tangibly or concretely affect your teaching. But when he isn't chanting japa, it's affecting the other students, and they're all starting not to chant japa. Then what do you do? Or, as it was put yesterday, that if someone is living in the temple and not going to Mangalarti, they're always sleeping through Mangalarti. So he has a problem. But what happens when everyone else starts thinking, half the other brahmacharis start thinking, well, he's sleeping through Mangalarti, I don't have to get up, so I should sleep through Mangalarti too. So whose problem is it then? So these kind of questions, they're subtle in the sense that the individual has a problem that's becoming the teacher's problem or it's becoming the temple president's problem. And the teacher or the temple president has to make sure that it doesn't become his problem too overtly. And my understanding of the simplest way to deal with this type of a complex situation, and it is complex, is you understand that the person has the problem, and his problem is probably, there should be some rules in the temple to stop it from affecting others. Like a temple should have a rule that everyone, for instance, that no one is allowed, everyone who lives in the temple must go to Mangalarti. Otherwise you can't live in the temple. If that rule is there, then it's the teacher's problem, because his duty, the temple president's problem, because his duty is to enforce the rules also. If the person was living outside the temple and wasn't coming to Mangalarti, then it would be more clearly the devotee's problem, not the temple president's problem. So it's probably, when something like that is occurring, it usually means someone's in the wrong position. So a student who has, and I've had young Gurukula students who have decided they're not going to chant Hare Krishna, and they have a problem, but it starts affecting the other students. And usually when someone's like that, it means that they should be in the Gurukula. And similarly, it means if someone's that can't attend any of the morning programs, and they're so they have such a different idea or a different ability in Krishna consciousness, let them stay outside. Because when you're staying outside, and you're going to Mangalarti one day a week, everyone's happy to see you one day a week. But if you're living in the temple and you go to Mangalarti one day a week, then everyone sees that you're not going 6 days a week. So it's better to be properly situated, and then something that's a problem in one situation isn't a problem in another situation. So those kind of things are tricky, and they're hard to deal with, but it doesn't, I don't think it really interferes with the principles that we learned yesterday. Any other questions on this? Now, how to deal with improper behavior. This is the rest of the lesson, very very simple in these recommendations. How to deal with improper behavior that's the student's problem, and how to deal with inappropriate behavior that's the teacher's problem. So when it's the student's problem, when it's the teacher's problem, he more or less has the duty to insist that the student stops acting the way he's doing. What? Because it's concretely and tangibly interfering with his teaching, and his teaching is his job. He has to do it. He can't allow one student to interfere with the learning, his teaching, and 30 other students' learning. So he can't allow one person's problem of not wanting to go to Mangalarti or not being able to go to Mangalarti. He can't stop that from 50 other people going to Mangalarti. He can't let that one person's problem become the problem of everyone else. So he has to evoke some authority at that point. And ultimately, he can't... Here's where the difference is. If someone's living outside, the rule is everyone who lives in the temple has to go to Mangalarti. So if someone is living outside, he can't force him. It's his problem. He can't force him to go to Mangalarti. What's he going to do? Come into his bed, wake him up, throw him in the shower every morning, you know, dress him, put the tilak on him, and then tie him up and carry him to Mangalarti and throw him into the temple room. He can't do that. But if the rule is that no one who's living in the temple can miss Mangalarti, everyone who lives in the temple must go to Mangalarti, he can insist that the person doesn't live in the temple. If you're not going to go, you have to choose. If you want to live in the temple, you want to choose to live in the temple, you have to choose to go to Mangalarti. So it's not black and white like this. But I know that temple presidents have so many problems because they're specifically making everyone else's problems, treating it as if it was their own problem. So how to deal with the problems that are your problems, and there are so there are so many ways. We just put direct instruction, assertiveness, evoking authority. There's counseling. There's sometimes there's bribery that you have to do in subtle ways with kids, you know, sweets, you know, or different alternative choices. You either have to do this or you have to do this. You choose. There's unlimited different ways that we try to affect the behavior of others. And the ultimate is authority. We don't start with authority. You have to do it or else you're out. But the ultimate is authority. But that is always there with the temple president, with the authority, with the teacher. That you say you have to do it. If you want to be in this position, you have to do it. Now, with the student's problem, when it's clearly the student's problem, and a difference would be, say if someone's not, if there's a rule in the temple that everyone who's in this temple must go to Mangalarti, and there's a student who's going to Mangalarti, a devotee, but he's very unhappy all the time. Doing his service, but he doesn't look happy. So the teacher, the temple president understands that. So what can he do? He can't say, okay, I'm the temple president, that you have to be happy. But why he can say that, and he can order the person to be happy. Or you can say the cause of your unhappiness is that you're not chanting better japa, or the cause of your unhappiness is you're not studying enough. So he may even be right, but you can't force someone to study. You can't force one to be happy. But what you can do is have a talk with the person. And we've listed that on page 131, when it's the student's problem or the devotee's problem, is an invitation to counseling. And to talk to the person in such a way that they understand that they have a problem. That's the first thing. And when they accept that they have a problem, then you start talking about how to deal with the problem. If they don't accept that they have a problem, that it's good to be the way they are, then there's nothing you can do, practically speaking, unless it's becoming your problem, and you have to deal with it as the authority. I order you to chant better rounds. I'm not going to do it. Yes, you are. I am not going to chant better rounds. Yes, you are. And what are you? What ultimately are you going to do? Grab his mouth and okay.
Hurry!
Ultimately, the reason why you don't deal with a subordinate's problem as if it was your problem is because you ultimately must run out of power. You can't force them. Because they're not, you know, if someone is submissive and completely surrendered, if you say you have a problem with this and he says, you are my teacher, you are my temple president, you are my spiritual master, you are my parent, yes, you have said this, I immediately accept everything you say, please instruct me how to solve my problem. So if the student or the child is like that, is Namamrita like that? No? When the children are like that, then if they're surrendered, there's no problem at all. Then immediately the teacher has full ability to instruct. But we're not talking about that situation. But also, on the other hand, sometimes a teacher will not always tell even the submissive student what to do because he wants him to learn how to apply his own intelligence. So these are the discriminations that a teacher has to make. He knows that he will not always be in the presence of his student, so he has to train him to think and apply the knowledge that he's given him as well. So when it's the student's problem, there's the invitation to counseling. You cannot counsel someone who doesn't want to be counseled. This is another thing that happens. I want to give you some advice. You have a problem, and I want to give you some advice. And the person is not interested in hearing the advice. Sometimes when you're talking to someone, you have a problem, you're unhappy about something, you're upset about something, you sort of just want to tell someone, and immediately they start giving you all this advice of all the things you have to do. And it's not really what you wanted. You know? So the counselor has to be sensitive to exactly what the person wants. He has to learn how to listen, and that will be the topic of the lessons in the next 3 days, which is the conclusion of this, on different levels that we can listen to people. Any other questions or comments?
I've heard that immediately someone seems to have a problem, you can either directly counsel them, or sometimes you can not put as much pressure on the one person by having a group thing. I feel like one person is not going to be the moral object, but sometimes you can have a group meeting and say that we all have to come to moral.
That's right.
Better. Does that fit in there? Anything like this?
Yeah, it's avoiding the confrontation. And you're saying in the group that everyone has to, you're telling them the law and telling them what's good for them to hope to inspire them. There's many different things you can do. You can also change the law that you only have to come to Mangalarti once a week and then there's no more problem from that point of view. You change the person's situation. Sometimes the person is, he's working in the restaurant, you know, till 12 o'clock at night. And there's the law that you have to come to Mangalarti, and because he's not coming to Mangalarti and he's a big leader, it's causing so many people are saying, well, he's not coming to Mangalarti, and you know, so why should I come? And why are they getting on my case? You know, why don't they get on everyone's case equally? So maybe the circumstances have to be changed or the law has to be changed. So there's so many things that can be done. We just wrote direct instruction, assertiveness, evoking authority. This is what we call preaching to people. Okay. So, I guess we can start the test if there are no more questions. Because tomorrow, we're almost at the end of the readings that have to be done. So read. We're going to cover possibly from 135 till 143. We probably won't cover all of it, but we're going to try. So please read from 135 to the end. And that will be the subject matter for the next 3 days. Not sure of the answer. You can try. But listen to the responses of the other students so that you make sure you understand the difference. Yes? Like to try?
Student, he doesn't disturb the teacher concretely.
What's the other word we use a lot?
Tangibly.
Tangibly and concretely. Externally. Well, tangibly and concretely. Yeah. And which is that? If he does. If it's a disturbance, a concrete and tangible disturbance to the teacher's teaching, then the teacher owns the problem. And he deals with it as he must deal with it. Now, on the other hand, when it's the student's problem, then the teacher should not accept that problem as if it is his own problem. Why? Why shouldn't the teacher accept the student's problem as if it were his own problem? Andrew? Yeah.
Because you become overburdened with problems.
Yes.
Then
yeah.
He has no power.
Yeah, he ultimately he doesn't have the power to solve them. Yeah.
If he regards the problem as his own problem, then he endeavors to solve it, but it is not said that student won't, his problem won't.
Yeah, so he'll run out of power at the same point. It may not be the right, he may not have the ability to solve it at that time. Even though he may have the right answer for him, and often when people give others advice, they're really giving advice on how they would solve the problem. But since we're all individuals, other people may have a completely different approach to the problem. So then what happens is the person rejects the answer, or he tries it and fails. Or he doesn't try it at all, or he's not in the mood to even consider it. And the problem exists, and even worse now, there is a problem in the relationship. Because if you give advice, if you offer someone a hand and say, take it, I'm going to help you, you take this, and the person doesn't take it, it gives trouble in the relationship. It's almost offensive. Prabhupada explains that if I tell them what to do and they don't do it, it's offensive. So, what I would like everyone to do now that we all clearly understand what a teacher-owned problem is and what a student-owned problem is, I think everyone has a pretty clear idea. Does anyone feel they need some more explanation on this? Does anyone feel that? We can talk about it further. Okay. Yes?
If a student sees the teacher is actually saying something too fast, the teacher doesn't like to answer the questions, whose problem is that? I don't know if it's in a category, but...
No, it doesn't. But whose problem is it? The student has a problem that he can't understand the things, and the teacher may have a problem and that he's talking too fast. So how does this, that's a whole other question. How does the subordinate deal with when he wants to tell the superior, the person in the superior position something? So that's a whole different topic, and it's an art. Usually, the wives have special access by the grace of Krishna to the problems of their husbands, but yet they have to be very careful, as all wives know, and as all husbands know, on how to explain the defect or the problem to the husband. Because if they do it improperly, just the husband's false ego becomes inflamed. So there's a shy, safe way to do it. The job gets done, and yet the relationship remains nicely intact. So that's a different science. You have to be humble, basically, and indirectly suggest it. Never confront directly. You're talking too fast, teacher. So that's going to end up with the student thrown out. For sure, even though it may be true, but there's breach of etiquette. And the false ego will come up and it's not proper. Now, what I would like everyone to do now, is since everyone, I believe, has a feel for the difference between a student problem and a teacher-owned problem, I want you to all think of two or three problems that you have that are your problems, not the problem, like my problem is that the teacher is talking too fast, so ultimately it's his. Think of problems that you actually have like that.
As a student.
As a student, as a person, think of two or three problems that you have, and we'll do a few interesting things on that. No one's going to be forced to reveal all their problems in front of everyone. But or you can also think of a few that you can talk about. Even just this exercise alone, just thinking about it is interesting enough. Think of something tangible. I think that might make it easier to do this exercise. And after a few minutes, I'll call on people, call on devotees, and we'll have a few little conversations as I improperly try to help you solve your problem.
By tangible?
Huh?
By tangible?
Well, just real actual problems that you think you have that disturb your mind. There are cobwebs in the bathroom.
Mushrooms,
yeah. It's a fact. You don't have to write them down because that may be incriminating. Okay, when you have two problems that you think you could, you might be able to discuss, this will come in handy in tomorrow's lesson too. Two or three? Raise your hand when you have them. Such a problem-free class. This is wonderful. That's what happens when you attend VIHE and just hear and chant in Vrindavan in association with devotees. Same problem happened when one would associate with Prabhupada. You'd have so many problems and confusions, and you'd go in front of him and he'd say, "Is everything all right?" And you felt so satisfied in his association that the sun was out, there was no darkness. But it can be things like not enough time to study this problem, that problem, anything. Any problem that is clearly that you own. Raise your hand when you have them, when you have two, at least two. Why don't you write them down then in code? So only you can understand. Anyone like a few minutes more? Think about this? Okay, now, when a student owns a problem, there are ways that a teacher can deal with them. Now, on page 135, the two paragraphs before the before those asterisks, we've mentioned what we'll call improper, although they're not improper, really, but they're ineffectual ways of dealing with student problems. Although these ways of ordering, threatening, moralizing, preaching, counseling, lecturing, lecturing logically, blaming, name-calling, ridiculing, psychoanalyzing, consoling, probing, interrogating, distracting, and humoring, although these sometimes may have their place, as a general rule, especially when there is a problem owned by the student, they are not effective in helping the student solve his problem. Remember, the teacher doesn't attempt to solve the problem right off for the student because he doesn't have the power to. So what I would like to do now, so out of those, I think we've listed 12 of these. Now out of these 12, we'll divide them into five basic groups. The first group is criticizing, which includes like threatening to. The second group is praising. The third group, advising. This is dustproof chalk. It's also reed-proof chalk. I think we're out of chalk. Huh?
Okay.
Thank you.
Four is probing. These are considered inappropriate and ineffectual responses. And the fifth one is diversion.
Now I'll show you why these are ineffectual. We'll do some role playing. Okay. I'm going to be asking for volunteers now. Now I'm the teacher here. This is my role as a teacher. Actually, okay, we'll do it. Everyone can sit at their seats though. And you're students, and you approach me, or I've approached you and said, it seems like you have a problem about something. And then your response to me is telling me something about your problem. Okay? So you already have listed some problems that you do have. So work on the real thing. Thank you. Any volunteers? For a start? Okay. So what's going on with you, Madan Mohan? So this, we're in role now. You're all just watching. And Madan Mohan has a problem.
Nothing.
Oh, that's great. Anyone else have a problem? Something's wrong with me. I don't seem to have a problem. No, is there something?
I'm supposed to.
You're supposed to have a problem.
And
yeah, you, I mean, you're supposed like we're gonna role play.
I thought I was supposed to like act in a way that showed that I had a problem. But I just wanted to try.
Okay, sounds like you don't understand what we're doing, right? What a problem. I think.
I have this problem understanding this group. Sorry, I should just.
Yeah, just stop.
Tell you what I.
Yeah.
I have a problem with that I tend to take things in an extreme way. I have a problem keeping things in perspective. Sometimes I over-exaggerate.
That's really foolish, isn't it?
Or
It's quite foolish. I mean, intelligent people don't do that. You should become more Krishna conscious. Okay, cut. How do you feel? Because you were actually trying to, how do you feel from your side? Even though we know we're playing now, but what was your reaction? This is one of the glories of role-playing, because you can watch things happen, you can watch your reactions when you're in role, and you can see effectively how it works. What was your reaction to that?
I guess I thought a lot of things, but I definitely didn't feel like I was saying, like there was any point saying anything else.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like I was actually getting a response from the group. Yeah. Care.
Okay. So that one was, we put that one as criticizing, or we could put it in, I didn't quite even get into advising.
Yeah.
Okay, let's try someone else. Now that didn't hurt, did it? Okay, and now we'll go to the next one.
So,
first of all, you have to be in the role a little bit and not be the student making believe he has a problem, but try to get into the mood of the problem.
Sorry, for a month I haven't had this problem in here. But I had this problem back in Houston. I'm with Vijaya. I spend my whole morning worshiping the deity. It's really nice. And the whole rest of the day, I've got to figure out how to get my japa done, my reading done, and do all this other stuff.
You're such a good devotee. This isn't a problem for you. You're so Krishna conscious. I see this. You're so Krishna conscious. You always get your rounds done. You're so devoted to your spiritual master. This isn't a problem for a good devotee like you.
That may be going on.
Okay.
That's actually how everybody treats me. That's the question. Good.
And Jazzy, that's Johnny. He's such a good devotee. Plenty of encouragement. You know, all those who think Krishna Kripa is a good devotee, raise your hand. See, don't worry about it. It's all right. Out of role, you're no longer a Krishna Kripa in Houston. Now, how do you feel about my response? It was so the opposite of the last response. The last one was more, I was criticizing, and this one was praising. How do you feel?
Well, pretty much the same way. What's the use of having a conversation about it? I'm coming for some help, and all you're saying, you don't have a problem. But then if I didn't think I had a problem, why would I come to you in the first place?
So these are all actually the considered roadblocks in communication. And this is generally how people respond. 90-95% of responses are like this, and they cause a lot of problems. Okay, also like with Madan Mohan, we could, along with criticizing, there's also, you could add threat in there, you know. What was your problem again there? That
Nintendo over-exaggerates.
Yeah. If you keep up with this kind of stuff, you're gonna, you know, you'll probably really have problems later on, especially in dealing with these kind of authorities. You know, you're gonna probably really have problems later on. So there's the element of threat put in there too, like that. Okay. Anyone else like to try? We'll go to the next one. Okay. Now, of course, the people often, they'll listen one or two sentences before they come out with either their praise or their criticism. Or in this case. Yeah.
I have this problem with laziness. And,
You're lazy?
Yeah.
You shouldn't be lazy. You should get up earlier, eat less. How much do you eat? Anyway, you should eat less. You eat less, especially in India. You should eat less. Finish. So that one's under advising. How do you feel?
I don't even know that.
So I'm over-exaggerating this. I'm over-exaggerating this because usually in a conversation, because I'm even cutting everyone. Anyway, I knew the answer to that one anyway, right after three words, so I felt perfectly right in cutting you off. But of course, people aren't. And when you come to someone with a problem, they're not as extreme as this often. But as soon as they start doing one of these three or four or five without going further, the same reaction will be there. Divide, praising. Okay, next one. Anyone else has one? Yeah, let's do it.
I have a problem with this course.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to try to sandwich a bit of breakfast or lunch in between. So much work to be done.
You have so much work to be done.
Yeah.
How many hours of classes do you have?
I have a lot.
No, how many hours? Exactly how many hours do you have?
8 hours.
8 hours is it in homework? How many courses is that?
Seven.
Seven courses, and how many hours of homework do you have? 2 hours of homework, that's 10 hours. How many hours do you sleep?
Five.
And eating? Eating? So, okay, eating hours. Huh?
My main problem is your
weight. No, just wait a second. How many hours do you eat?
One and a half hours.
1.5 hours eating? Do you spend time in the restaurant?
Waiting,
waiting. But you do spend time in the restaurant. You do spend time in the restaurant, don't you? Sometimes you're in the lobby, just sitting in the lobby.
Sometimes.
Yeah. This is cross-examining. But how do you feel? I'm talking like that. Okay, you're out of role. How do you feel?
Interested to talk because you're always getting on the conversation.
Okay, so we did better with that one. But did you feel a little defensive like that?
A little, yeah.
Humble soul. And the last one in this category is diverting. An example of diverting. Anyone have a problem that needs diverting? What was the problem? Yeah. You have bad handwriting. Anyway, so does my son Jai Gurupati. He has really bad handwriting. Actually, my whole family has bad handwriting. My mother even had bad handwriting. She said, my handwriting is better than a lot of what I practice a lot. Anyway, handwriting isn't such a bad problem. Anyway, even Albert Einstein had a bad handwriting. It doesn't reflect on anything else like that. And I live life. It's funny. Everything is in handwriting. So do you have any real problems? So that one is diversion, which includes changing the subject, making jokes out of it, and things like that. And you want it, often we do that just so, you know, the person's really seriously thinking about a heavy problem. And then you think they're worrying about it too much, so the answer is to just have them stop thinking about it temporarily. And unfortunately, that won't work, because if it's a problem, it's there for me. It's going to come up again and again. So, we remember, these are called roadblocks to problem solving, or roadblocks to communication. They stand in the way of communication taking place. We're probably in this section, Maharaj, we're going to probably start intruding on your in your area. Huh?
Be enhancing.
So these aren't useful if a student has a problem. They don't foster communication, but actually they get in the way of communication. Now, almost the main point that we wish to bring out by this exercise and this demonstration is that these type of responses don't set up the needed atmosphere for true communication to take place. Because I've tried to stress this point that the teacher, he does something very subtle in the teaching. Most of the teaching is accomplished in the setting up of the atmosphere, the mood of the classroom, the mood of the relationship, so that the class or the students want to learn. It is like when someone is trying, it's like when you're cooking, if the food looks good and it smells good, then people want to eat it. And if it's not served on a green leaf plate, and everything looks greeny from turmeric, people want to eat if it's if the atmosphere is right. But if someone doesn't want to eat, it's so hard to get them to eat. It's so hard if someone doesn't want to eat. So the cook knows how to get the atmosphere, the hunger blazing, and the teacher somehow or another, magically it seems, he makes the teaching look easy because of his ability to make the students want to learn what he is teaching. And then it's very easy, it's a simple matter of communication. So these responses do not help the atmosphere. They do not open up the heart of the student. They tend to make the student's heart blocked, so he doesn't want to speak anymore. This is the tendency. This is, again, these aren't absolutes that one should not do these things, but as a general rule, when it's the student's problem, they do not help open up the atmosphere. Now, in addition to making these responses to student-own problems, in addition to them being hard on the student, they're also hard on the teacher. Because one out of two or three things usually happens. One is that when a student comes forward with a problem and he thinks his job is to immediately solve the problem, advising, or he has to probe deeply and understand everything, or he has to somehow or another solve the problem. Usually teachers will feel there are so many problems that I have to solve, and who am I? I'm very inadequate to do it. Because he's taking all the problems on his own shoulders, but actually he can't solve them. At best, he can help the student solve his own problems. So he will feel inadequate. Or usually what happens, you give some advice and it either doesn't work or the student never takes it. And then he feels very rejected and blockages come up in the relationship. And ultimately, a third reason from the teacher's side that it's not effective is that no teacher has it in his power to solve everyone's problems. So he will feel overburdened with all the problems of everyone he's dealing with. So for these reasons, these type of responses are not considered effective. But that doesn't mean that teachers shouldn't help students with their problems. Because naturally, those in the superior position, like teachers, their job, their natural disposition of heart is to help as possible. But the difference in attitude is he's not going to solve the problem, but he's going to help the students solve their own problems if the student wants his help. There's a subtle difference in attitude that makes all the difference. Now what we're going to recommend in the next 3 days, that we'll finish off this course and we will attempt to teach techniques of listening. And listening is a very powerful method to help people solve their problems. Or even put the teacher in a better position where he can advise if it's appropriate. So listening is very important. Now, we've addressed this with quite a few quotes from Prabhupada, showing the value of listening. One of the main reasons is that unless you are directly connected to the super soul, you don't really know what the problem is. And I've seen it so many times, I've done it myself. Immediately, one chirps in his advice, very quickly, very superficially, without deeply understanding what the problem actually is. Without having listened thoroughly, we just answer the problem with pat answers. One example that he said his opinion was that people don't really want, more often than not, people don't want you to solve their problems, they just want someone to talk to. So we immediately want to get in there and be the hero and solve the problem. And often it's not even really needed. And just by talking, you know, the steam is out of the kettle and there's not going to be an explosion. Often, not always, but often.
In this case, I felt that, you were using some of the technical responses of a person who is interested in understanding hearing. So I actually felt that beneath whatever you were saying, that you were actually interested, and that you were saying these things just sort of brought it to the more obvious and identifiable level.
So you mean your concern for the individual was there, you felt?
But what that reminded me of is how sometimes I've seen people adopt the terminology or the gestures of a person who's interested. Where the interest is actually absent, and it ends up their lack of interest ends up being communicated through the stiff use of these techniques. So,
through the stiff use of the techniques?
Yeah, the techniques aren't held together by genuine interest, so they just end up looking empty.
So, you know, it's the same point that we spoke of in the beginning of the class on the teaching techniques. They could be either manipulative or hollow for a sensitive person. But if the Krishna consciousness is there, if the true concern is there, if the genuine desire to teach something is there, then these things are additive to it. Now, the one that's most interesting in this four is the fourth one. We're not going to go into it much today, but this responding with understanding is very, very powerful. It's very powerful. It's not complete in itself, but it's very powerful. I have friends who were trained in this way before they were devotees on this particular technique, that when people would come in great distress, wishing to commit suicide and wishing to do something horrible and rash, all they were taught as basic training is this technique of responding with understanding, because it's so powerful, it can alleviate the pressure in someone else's mind and take them quite far to solving their problems. So it is actually a very powerful technique. But as Madan Mohan is pointing out, that let's try to get the heart of the teacher in line with the technique as the prime thing. That one should be concerned with the students, otherwise one practically shouldn't be counseling a person. Okay. The first technique of the nonverbal
listening, and then there's some physical signs that you're listening, and then there is some verbal announcements that you're listening to let the person know you're awake by saying, yes, interesting, the person understands you're awake, and then there are probes to get more information. These all show that the person is listening and interested to listen. This next one will also show that the person or the teacher is actually not only listening, but he's understanding. The communication has been completed because I'm speaking and the teacher or the person acting as the hearer has understood what I've said, right? So this is what we're going to cover. I think we won't go any further now. We'll go into this tomorrow. Any other questions? If not, we have a few more minutes and we can do some writing and then we'll break a little early as opposed to the late that we usually do. Questions?
So, sometimes a person in a authority role is opposed by someone else, and but the person in the authority role has a lot of things on his mind, a lot of pressure, shortage of time, and it seems like, at least when I've been in some role like that, I felt a lack of myself sometimes to be able, to give of myself to the person when they need it, just because I'll start talking to them and I realize it's even very enjoyable to have an exchange with the person, but then I think I've got to do this other thing, I can't keep talking to this person. Then you feel like, I feel myself giving kind of a superficial, So I just
wanted
to know how one can get out of that.
Well, it's hard to ask a person with a disease how he should cure it. I find myself in that position really a lot. So much to do with, and so much pressure that I feel on me that I'm not open. The door is locked, practically speaking. When someone walks in the room, they feel... laser, you've had that experience. I'm quite good at that too. They don't feel welcome. So what to do about that? Just, individually, there may not be very much we can do about it. Because maybe we do have so much to do that we can't stop it. But. When I lament about my own lack, at least what should be done is when someone comes in, give them a welcome, make them feel welcome, some water, and then after 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, maybe you can say, I'm so busy now, I'd really like to talk to you. But that takes getting out of the mode of passion even to do that, and that's often hard to do too. Another angle on it, is that in my, as I said before, that so many devotees do need someone to talk to, and yet there are the managers who need, there's so much work to be done. So it would seem to me helpful if there was a division of labor between managers and counselors. I think that would help me, very helpful. So that's Brahman and Kshatriyas. So a little institution of, it doesn't have to be a big official thing, but if someone is good in counseling, it can be a full-time engagement for him. I know devotees, is practically that's their service. And certainly when one has many disciples, it would seem that part of his service is talking to them and guiding them. And not being so busy with management that you have no time to deal with the people who are dependent on you. It would seem that would be a saner way of organization. So let those who want to manage, manage. And let those who want to counsel, counsel. And people often would rather get counseling from those who are not managing them also, because they often feel a conflict of interest on the person's behalf, that, you know, my problem is often with the service that I'm doing, or something to do with the service, and the manager's job, his prime thing is to make sure that the service goes on, often. So, and when you come to him, often devotees feel he has a predisposition toward just telling him to, you know, just patting him on the back and, you know, winding him up a little bit more. You can do it, Krishna Kripa, don't worry about your job. It's all right, Prabhu. But, you know, you do that. What happens, unfortunately, after years of that, and, you know, you start feeling no one really cares about you, you start thinking that, you know, everyone's only caring about that the service gets done. And then you feel shelterless, and devotees shouldn't feel shelterless because they'll take shelter of the material energy. So, this point about counselor, it's really a question of shelter. So if we feel that the person's interest is just our interest and he's doing the best thing for us, then we don't mind if he cranks us up and just pushes us out. But we have to be convinced that this person has our self-interest as foremost in his mind. Any other questions or comments? So these topics are heavy, revolutionary, but very, very important. These are also, this especially that we'll learn tomorrow about responding with understanding. Even in discussion, that we talked about one of the procedures being discussion. This is very helpful, using this technique in leading a discussion. Questions? Comments?
Are we going to do the writing right after this?
We're going to do the writing right now.
I was wondering if before the end of the class, before the end of the session is over, one day or the second or the last day, we could write down, if we had the opportunity to teach, what would we teach? And maybe we can
Okay. Because we actually started in that way, didn't we? Did we start in that way? What, teaching in ISKCON? I considered it. Anyway, we talked about different ways we could teach in ISKCON, maybe. Or was that last semester or the semester before? Did we talk about that? Different ways that we teach in ISKCON? Yes? Okay, at least one person remembers.
Okay.
There was actually, you reminded me that there was one other thing that I would like to beg of the devotees. We have two more classes, but I'd like to do it today. Jaya Dvaita Swami, who is a very dear and old friend of mine, he wrote me a letter. I asked him something, he wrote me a letter, and he happened to mention that BTG was having problems. Now, Jaya Dvaita Swami was one of the founding fathers of the DAAG too, and he was one of the main inspirations, so we owe him some debt in that regard as well. But aside from that, Prabhupada's, the backbone of the Krishna Consciousness Movement, back to Godhead Magazine, is having some problems. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not sure how everyone else feels, the problem isn't the quality of the magazine. I personally think the magazine is glorious. I found even personally how Prabhupada has spoken to me through the magazine and given me very pertinent instructions. It's very powerful, I find, and I like the new magazine even more than I like the old magazine. But the basic problem that it's having is that there aren't enough
subscribers. I would like to beg some dakshin from you, dear students. I said I would humbly request that you all, if you don't already have it, or even if you do have it, please get a subscription to Back to Godhead magazine. This will help. It will help encourage Deutsche Maharaj if we can send him a whole bunch of subscriptions. And also, you'll all be getting Back to Godhead magazine. So I'm humbly requesting that everyone does this, get a subscription. I can tell you the price. I think it's one or two devotees, but three devotees in the United States. In the United States, it's $18 for the year. That's what it's for too. Unfortunately, in the rest of the world, it's because they have to air mail it, it's $32 for the 6 issues. So it's a little expensive like that. But if you can possibly afford doing this, I would very much appreciate it, and certainly Jai Dwaita Swami would appreciate it, and Prabhupada would appreciate it too. So we have the forms. Arjuna has them in the office, so if everyone could do that, we'd be very much thrilled. And if by chance you would like to do it and you don't have the finances at your disposal right now to do it, Back to Godhead has informed us they will bill you. So you don't have to worry about that. It would be such a shame if they have to stop publishing right now. Where is that name? But you can get one for a friend. And that was what we thought of. If devotees already have subscriptions, get one for a friend.
Actually, I think they kind of canceled that program with Give Your Life Only. You get a lifetime subscription with Back to Godhead magazine.
Okay, you still need a subscription, Bhakti Dev.
The financial situation that it's in, it's very difficult for them. I mean, they actually need about double the amount of subscriptions than what they've got. So they're not.
Are they still sending you them? Are you still getting your magazine?
We send them in Britain. In Britain, we send out 2,000 magazines.
That's a lot. How many? I think they have 8,000 total subscriptions. And it's 2,000 for me. Okay, so please do this. You can. It's 5 minutes left in class, so you can take that 5 minutes to write.